Eve to you, Hobbs. Eve to you, Hobbs. How you doing, Hob?
That's just the kind of things I do.
Well, we have wildfires here in western North Carolina. We have the tsunami, Matt, that occurred where?
The tsunami?
Yeah.
I don't know.
What are you doing? Are you sitting over there reading about cosmicism?
45 seconds, fellas.
What? 45 seconds? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
45.
Prepare to engage, Matt.
45 seconds.
Prepare to engage, everyone.
Prepared.
45 seconds before news from the front. Oh, I miss this.
Yeah, I know, right? You love us. Super Moon.
Burn it in.
Hobbs.
Hobbs. All right, here we go, boys.
Standing by, Hobbs.
Home solution. 2-1. We're live.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Geronimo!
Is the Grimlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grimlian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, hiding out from wildfires here in western North Carolina, I am your host, Micah Hanks. And you've locked in to the proper space-time coordinates. It is the Grimlian Report. Welcome, one and all. Glad to have you guys all here. Tonight, we'll be getting to the news, a few listener emails, discussing a bit in the way of science and mysteries, but most importantly, consciousness, what all that has to do with the brain, with language, how we learn, and whether there are secret facets within the mind that neuroscience hasn't quite tapped into just yet. A lot on the table to discuss. We might even get into a bit of, well, cosmicism later on, a branch of philosophy that is often underrated, less often discussed, something that should be taken into consideration more often. We may be doing that, of course. Who better to do it with than the Grimlian Reverend himself, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good evening, Matt.
And a good evening to you.
I am so happy that we have survived election week, because it was a week full of endeavors for you and I. More on that in just a moment. Because again, while the sky continues to fall here in America, well, my homeland is burning. Lots to be concerned about, including evacuations that are occurring just a few miles from here. Don't worry, we're safe. We're holed up in the bunker. We're safer than Julian Assange in an embassy. Boy, I've got to stop using that joke. But I did write an article about that for Mysterious Universe over the weekend, and how Assange may not have been right on all points with regard to his expectations for the U.S. election. But hey, we're all tired of hearing about that by now, right? Let's get to some fun stuff. Before we do, back in Master Control, Fort Smith, Arkansas, our producer. He has been for a long time. I hope he will continue to be for quite some time to come. Because as we were just saying prior to air tonight, boy, we miss this. I get to hear his voice every week, and yet I never get to hear it enough. Race Hobbs, how are you, sir?
I am rolling.
Rolling. Better than what we're doing, which is roasting. Here it is, November. Should be cooling down, and we've got fires all over the place in western North Carolina.
No, that is I tell you, it's finally started to cool down here in the river. Hobbs, Trump, Hobbs.
I love it. That was a perfect setup, by the way.
Yeah.
Matt, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm all right. A little starting to get choked up with all the smoke in the air upstairs.
Well, they're actually advising that in western North Carolina, first of all, athletic programs that do training and exercises and games outside, that they need to limit that right now. People are advised not to be outside too much if they can help it at all, especially, however, if you have any kind of an infection or any kind of a condition in which you may become irritated from inhaling smoke. Okay, lung irritation can ensue. Matt, they are evacuating just over that mountain. Up and over there. You know, as you and I both know, I mean, this far underground, wherever there are mountains, there are proportional depths of caves below ground, which is why we are where we are.
Yes. Absolutely.
And, of course, you know, the prevalence of karstic caves throughout this region, it makes it perfect for underground abodes. So, yeah, we're safe here in the bunker for now. But above ground, it is scorched earth in western North Carolina. We have had not one, not two, I believe, three significant wildfires that have broken out. Jim Harold over the weekend was texting me, by the way, and he was saying, "Hey, Micah, I just hope you're safe, man. I keep hearing about these fires down there where you are." And initially, I think we did touch on it last week, they weren't really close, but now, I mean, they're really close, just a few miles away from above ground central here at Graylian International Studios.
Yeah, apparently they've been spreading like wildfire.
Oh!
But one of the ones, I believe, down near Nantahala, which isn't too far from us, has been upgraded to the second top priority wildfire in the entire nation.
Yeah.
It keeps spreading, and they've only got it something like 15% contained in over a week.
Well, you know, what's funny, Matt, as you do know, and by the way, I finally have the mystery of the malfunctioning headlight problem fixed. Yeah, as of today. Finally, yeah. Race, you would really have enjoyed watching Micah becoming his own car maintenance professional and caretaker.
I don't know if you remember, I was on the phone with you. Oh, my God.
Somebody didn't like that.
old buddies saying hi to the UPS delivery guy. But I was on the phone with you while you were in transit trying to get that issue taken care of.
Yes, yes. Well, I finally got it fixed today. Part of the problem is that the headlight in question requires removal of the battery to be able to get to the area, and apparently that was kind of causing an issue. So I don't want to say much more than merely to say that the problem, I think, that I was experiencing was operator error, further exacerbated by the fact that I was mostly attempting this operation in darkness, and that my associate, Mr. Gilpin, who a few nights ago was holding the light while I was attempting this maneuver in sheer darkness, well, he may or may not have been somewhat intoxicated. I was not, by the way. I was not. I don't drive around while under the influence, but I dropped by to visit him, and I'll tell you why. I got a distress signal from him. I couldn't call it anything but a distress signal. My good friend Ty, he is a friend and a fellow philosopher, literally. I mean, he actually has a philosophy degree, and he's a few years older than me, but Ty plays mandolin, and he and I, we just play music together anytime that we can because we enjoy playing music together. He is a friend, and he's one of those guys that playing music with Ty Gilpin is not a job. It is fun. And he sent me a text. He asked where I was, and we had played a festival up in Highlands earlier that day. Nitrograss and I, really, really good. It was an early morning spot during this all-day festival thing that they were doing, but it was a lot of fun. I got to catch up with my friend Wanda, and we were chatting about the state of affairs in America today. And that's exactly what I ended up talking about with Ty. I mean, a lot of people are feeling really strange about things because, well, let me just put it to you this way. And again, you know, I'm... With middle theory, we are centrists. That doesn't mean that we don't have opinions, but we're trying to take a middle-of-the-road approach to understanding things so that a little of the dogmatism and a little bit of the propagandizing of positions and news stories in general is left at the door. Middle theory being our other podcast and being primarily political this year, it's news and current events. History, we talk about conspiracy theories, a lot of things, but it has been, with news being primarily what we discuss, it has been mostly political the last few months. And so it's going to be nice to get away from some of that, although naturally the aftermath of Donald Trump's election will have to be discussed. And whether you support the guy or you are like many thousands who have taken to the streets in protest, I don't think anyone can argue the fact that America is going through some interesting times right now. Now, Matt Oakley was here in studio with me Tuesday night. We did 4 hours, he and McNonymous and I, of election coverage. And it's incredible because I thought, well, it being election coverage, you know, the next morning everybody knows who got elected, so they don't want to hear us talking for 4 hours about who in likelihood is going to win the presidency. But Matt, I have continued to get messages from people over the last few days asking, when are you going to put the election coverage up? You did record it, right? Can we listen? Are you going to put it up on the podcast feed in addition to YouTube, where it was archived? You know, Kat, our friend, you know, one of our friends and also a fader not, she was hanging out with us last April in Ozark, the, where, you know, in the Ozarks, Eureka Springs. And she had said, you know, when are you going to put it up on the podcast? I mean, a lot of us would like to hear that. So by popular demand, we put, actually, after I took out all the breaks and things, it was about 3.5 hours. But yeah, we've included that on the Middle Theory feed. You can find that at middletheory.com. It's the first post. Stream it, listen to it live. Well, it's not live now, but it was recorded live, and you can stream it in real time and listen at any time that you so choose, because a lot of people were like, we'd like to hear the analysis you provided. So, yeah, interesting times indeed. And yes, with the wildfires going on, it's not just here in America. Although I do want to say about those wildfires, Matt, you said that the one that's occurring, which one was it again?
Nantahala, I believe.
Okay, that's probably one of the biggest ones. And again, you know, one of our beautiful, pristine wilderness, protected wilderness areas, they're the Nantahala National Forest, which is over in the direction where we performed with at the Highlands Festival the other day. You know, again, that's become really one of the chief focuses of firefighters in this part of the country. And there are people from outside of North Carolina, from neighboring states, who are coming in to aid in the effort of, you know, trying to put out these fires. But the one closest to us, I would say there are people only maybe 25 miles away, Matt, maybe less than that, who are undergoing manual evacuations. Yeah. That is the Chimney Rock and Lake Lure area. Fortunately, again, there's an entire mountain range. That's what's known as the Hickory Nut Gap Gorge. And that mountain range, being a few miles away from where we're located in eastern Asheville in the Graylin Bunker, I think we're well protected. But it's a little freaky to know that those evacuations are not only mandatory, but occurring that close to us.
Yeah, I'm with you. And it's interesting how much the smoke and, you know, haze has spread all over the area. I believe I came over here to the bunker last week, and as I pulled in, I, you know, probably about 5-6 miles from here, I started noticing that haze and that real, you know, campfire type smell. I was like, man, on my side of town, we don't have any of this. Well, lo and behold, what, 3 days later, it really set in, and it's pretty much over the entire Asheville area at this point.
It has been, yeah, it has really been crazy. So Adam Loyal's out there in the live listening audience right now, of course, good friend of ours. He's been on the show before. He has the Friends to Know podcast. He's tweeting at us saying, be there or be square. So we hope a lot of you guys out there, if you're on Twitter, hey, why don't you send along salutations at Micah Hanks and at Graylin Reverend. That's how you reach us. You can also tweet at Graylin Report. Those are the ways to reach us throughout the program. We love to hear from you via your tweets. You can email, of course, info@MicahHanks, info@GraylinReport. Those are ways to reach us. And I think that with the new and improved KGRA facilities, before long, we're going to have a much more functional chat room. I hope to be able to regularly get into that chat room with you guys and chat with you, because we did that on election night, and it was great to have the running dialogue from people in our own little MIBIT chat window. Hell, maybe I'll just reinstitute that once again.
Yeah, it was fun to get in there.
Yeah, I mean, I could really, we have the infrastructure, we could do that. I just need to embed the streaming player for KGRA on the Graylin page, but then use our own chat room. There is a KGRA chat room, but for some reason I've noticed certain browsers have a little trouble loading that. By the way, okay, in addition to wildfires, in addition to the sky falling following the election, we've also had this 7.8 magnitude earthquake that struck New Zealand early on Monday, which would have been late Sunday night over here on our side of the pond. And it was, at the time I first saw the stories, they were saying it was a tsunami warning, but yeah, it triggered an actual tsunami that hit the coast a couple of hours after the initial shock. This according to New Zealand's Weather Watch. And aftershocks are still being felt across that country. Live Science reports today, officials are saying at least 2 people were killed by this natural disaster. Now, New Zealand's South Island was hit again by that 7.8 magnitude earthquake at around 12:02 a.m. local time on Monday. The quake's epicenter was northeast of Christchurch, but it was felt as far away as New Zealand's capital of Wellington, which is located 120 miles away on the North Island. This according to BBC. U.S. Geological Survey, of course, was monitoring this. They said tsunami waves over 7 feet tall hit the coast about 2 hours after the initial quake. WeatherWatch also reports that although authorities have not lifted the tsunami alert, the BBC is also saying this, by the way, officials are still looking for residents and asking them to stay away from the shore. I do know that we have a lot of listeners in that part of the world, so I hope you guys are safe. Be sure and stay tuned in to the Weather Service. And, of course, emergency preparedness is always important, so you guys have probably been down this road before. Take every measure required in order to ensure your safety.
And I don't know if you saw earlier, we actually got a tweet at us earlier from Jared Drake, one of the listeners out there, who appears to be in New Zealand. And he gave us this article right here, strange glowing in the sky, possibly earthquake lightning.
Very good.
And a lot of people have been reporting on this and saying that they saw these strange lights appear in the sky. It's a phenomenon that's been reported for centuries during and after earthquakes, of course.
Well, we've talked about it a good bit on this show. More than just your classic Fortiana, what I love are nature's anomalies, Earth-like phenomena. Matt, you and I, when was the last time you came down to Brown Mountain with me, by the way?
Oh, it's been a long time.
It's been a few years. You know, we should... This is a... Oh, I didn't even think about this. Matt, there is some anecdotal data, although there's some experimental data, too, that somewhat supports this. It's a bit nebulous with the Brown Mountain phenomena, because it's not the kind of thing that you can literally, as one might say, capture lightning in a jar and then just, you know, study it. The laboratory is the field as it relates to that. But there is some experimental data that suggests that when there have been forest fires, the carbon due to the smoke that's present in the air may be more conducive to the formation of those natural illuminations down there. So really, sometime this week... I mean, we should try and get down to Brown Mountain.
Yeah, we need to.
For a viewing, and I would love to see if people in the Linville Gorge Wilderness are maybe reporting any increased appearances of the lights. Dr. Dan Caton at Appalachian State University, he actually has an array of cameras and had managed earlier this year to capture something very unusual on one of them that has, to his, this is what he said, it's sort of, you know, reinvigorated his interest in the phenomena. Because he said it seemed to actually be some independent, free-floating illumination over the Brown Mountain Ridge that both cameras managed to capture. It seemed to be transient. It was coming and going throughout the night. And there was a paper that was published last year by John Durr and, Robert Theriault and two other authors. And they had made the case that probably what's happening at Brown Mountain, the whole paper wasn't about that, but there were certain, actually, not just one, I think there were at least two, maybe three references to the Brown Mountain lights in the Linville Gorge. They try to connect the appearances of those illuminations with earthquake phenomena. And again, we are on what's called the Brevard Thrust Fault right through this region. So it's not impossible that indeed there are probably tectonic and geological factors that are contributing to the formation of some of these lights, like the earthquake lights, which now you, according to Jared Drake, and thank you, Jared, by the way, good to hear from you, and thank you for sending that along. I hadn't actually seen that before we went to air, so I'm glad you caught that, because, prior to these earthquakes, this is what's kind of interesting. We recognize that now as a plasma kind of a phenomena that results from the stress that's occurring, prior to seismic events like this. But in ancient times, it was often said that ghost lights preceded catastrophes. And whenever someone saw ghost lights or strange illuminations, they would, of course, attribute it to something paranormal, but they knew that these were harbingers of doom. And I think that there's probably a good case to be made for why people throughout the centuries have associated things like what they called ghost lights with these kind of doomsday scenarios and bad luck, ill fortune, deaths and things. Because, really, in likelihood, they would see these lights and then there would be something like an earthquake and people would die. And modern scientists now seek to try and be able to better predict earthquakes based on the appearance of geological phenomena like earthquake lights. But, even in ancient times, people no doubt attributing something more superstitious or paranormal to this, but they nonetheless caught that connection between, we see lights and we know something bad might happen, so take heed. So there's actually a bit of science that we recognize today that is directly paralleled by those ancient superstitions and traditions involving ghost lights.
And you've got to love the superstitions and traditions, though. I was just, while we were talking about the Brown Mountain lights, was thrown back to the old folklore and stuff about that specific phenomena, specifically the old song, the old bluegrass song.
Yeah.
Song. Do you remember that?
We had a request for that when we played the event there in Highlands on Saturday. The one request we got, because it was a festival kind of a thing, so people weren't really making requests, but one woman made her way down to the front of the stage and asked us. She said, "Can you sing the Ballad of the Brown Mountain Light?" And I said, "Wow, we never get that request."
It's a great song.
Yeah. And so we actually did perform it that morning. So all the more reason maybe to get down there and see what's happening. In terms of other strange illuminations that might be appearing in the sky, you may have noticed there's a supermoon occurring right now. And with the smoke that's filling the air, I got to tell you, the moon looked particularly eerie last night. I mean, it was this dull red, Melissa Jane was in New York, and she said, you know, Micah, where I sit here in my apartment and I'm writing, the moon, I get a full hour of the moon rising, and she took pictures from New York and sent me those images. And I initially told her, I said, MJ, we won't be able to see the moon here with all the smoke in the air, but sure enough, there was no cloud layer. It was merely the smoke in the air. So the moon rose, it was full, it was bright, but it was red. It looked like a blood moon during the supermoon. And would you believe people are already asking me, they're like, Micah, with all that smoke down there, if you can see the moon, try and get some pictures. So later tonight, we're going to have to open the Grayling Observatory, and we're going to try and get some good, clear photos. I'm known for doing this. I'll take my telescope. I've got my Celestron. I love to try and get good images of the moon, and this is going to be the largest supermoon we will have until the 2030s.
Okay. I believe 2036 is when I saw.
I think so, yeah. So this is going to be one of those unique occasions, and although I wish that the conditions were more clear, the dry weather is conducive to the fires, and hence the smoke in the air is going to make this an interesting-looking moon, so all the more reason maybe for me to get those pictures. We'll try and put those up on Twitter, and maybe even include a few there with the show notes at graylianreport.com once the podcast goes live. Gosh, I mean, look, we haven't even gotten to any news, and look how much good conversation we're having here. We're talking about tsunamis, supermoons, wildfires, sky falling. Yeah, interesting times. Not end times, though, guys. And let me just remind you, no matter where you stand or how you feel about the current state of politics in America, one thing we all need to recognize and remember, life does go on, and it may seem difficult for some of you. Some of you may be elated, okay? I like to take things in stride, and we come together here on this show to sometimes put aside our concerns and unite together in knowledge and that connectedness that we all share and our ability to put our minds and our hearts behind things in a way that brings us together. You know, sharing knowledge and sharing our passion for knowledge is something that's really important. Again, I got to tell you, this is one reason why very seldom do you hear us doing promotions and things on the Graylian Report, but Gaia contacted me. And when they said we would like to sponsor the Graylian Report, I mean, we really like your podcast, we listen. And I said, I really appreciate what you guys do. And again, I've actually been to their studios. I've actually been a guest on George Norrie's show. And we did two episodes, and I liked George, and he was gracious enough to allow me to come on and talk about anything I wanted to. And hence, when I talk about these kind of things, you know, UFOs or whatever else, I tend to take what I call a more skeptical approach to things. And also, I try to present information that is backed by science. And my personal conviction is that we need knowledge, and we need to be able to prevent the spread of bad information. And hence, my role that I play in all this is, especially with the Graylian Report, we try to put good, reliable information out for people. We cover the news. We don't just have guests all the time. We don't just talk to guests. You know, we put together a show for folks that they can listen to, they can enjoy, and that they can learn from, most importantly. Gaia, they do a lot of that too. And, you know, to those who seek relentlessly, who never really settle for the status quo and whose curiosity is almost too great to ever be satisfied, Gaia is, as they say, honored to facilitate exploration of life's greatest mysteries, a lot like what we do here on this show. It's for people like you that they provide key experts, writers, and luminaries who are not afraid to connect the dots and who meet eye to eye with truth as they work on the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, the unexplained, and yes, science, the study of space, the study of nature, all these things too. And at Gaia, they believe that we are all truth seekers and that we couldn't be more excited to explore life's real final frontiers together. Gaia, G-A-I-A, .com. We have a special landing page, gaia.com/Graylian. Check that out, gaia.com/Graylian. It's where you can find out about some of the programs that we like that they offer. You definitely will want to check them out. We're all working toward common goals, and I know that my goal with this podcast always has been not only to educate others if I can, but to educate myself. And my opinions and my attitudes have changed a lot over the years. Every week, it's a little adventure we go on together. Every week, I hope that people feel like they bring something away from the discussions we have on this show and that they've learned something. But most importantly, I know that from you guys and our interactions and the discussions Matt and Race and I and our guests have, I learn things too, and that's really important. So we're going to continue the journey together here on the Graylian Report right after this. more strange than a swarm of cyclone-tracking microsatellites. I'm Micah Hanks, along with the Graylian Reverend Mr. Matt Oakley, who's not really a reverend at all, but he has very kind eyes. It is the Graylian Report. Guys, glad, as always, to be here with you. About those cyclone-tracking microsatellites, Tech Times actually did report that with storms likely to become stronger and more destructive in the years to come, NASA is launching a series of these microsatellites. Here's really what they have in mind, okay? And I'm infinitely interested in this kind of a thing. NASA is looking to use a fleet of microsatellites to closely monitor the development of weather patterns in different parts of the world. The American Space Agency announced on Friday, November 11th, that it has already begun preparations for the launch of its Cyclone Global Navigation Satellite System, otherwise known as the CGNS.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was going to come out as like an anagram or something.
No, Joe.
No, Joe.
Yeah, but this will be launched next month, Matt. The project's goal is accurately to measure different factors that lead to the formation of hurricanes and tropical cyclones. It's also going to collect data on the intensity of weather disturbances, track their movement across the globe, and even calculate, they hope, the chances of storm surges occurring, which is kind of interesting because we were talking about being able to predict things like earthquakes in the last segment and how maybe in ancient times people were to a certain extent able to know maybe within a few hours of when a significant earthquake and thus maybe something else like, you know, a tsunami is likely to occur too. And they were able to discern these kind of things through what were perceived as superstitions, but modern science helps us to understand more and more as time goes on. Well, we're going to be trying to use science to track what are expected to be stronger and more destructive storms. Of course, the reason for the stronger and more destructive storms, it is believed, will be anthropogenic climate change, which, that's interesting because that reminds me of something I want to get to here in a moment. When we get to our listener emails, James Waldo, who's one of my favorite email writers in our listening audience, he's a scientist himself, and he often sends in a lot of really good information. And he had written in response to the discussion that you and Jason and I had last week about our research in Charleston and some of the archaeological stuff, and he had a question. And although I was able to provide a bit of clarification as to certain points, he brought up something that's rather esoteric as it relates to climate science, which I have a lot of questions about. If we have any climate scientists in the audience, and we've got a lot of geologists and a lot of biologists out there, especially people in the field of cell microbiology, I would love, though, to be able to speak and maybe get add to our proverbial Graylian Report Invisible College. That is, the experts behind the scenes often can't put their name behind the communications that they share with me, but they nonetheless advise us on issues as it relates to science. You know, for any naysayer out there who wants to say that, oh, you guys are just silly, and you talk about, you know, goofy, kooky, woo-woo, paranormal kind of stuff, I mean, you need to know there are a lot of people in the academic community, and especially in the fields of the sciences, who, on a weekly basis, you know, they confer with me, and I confer with them, and I go to them when I have questions when we discuss these kind of stories. So anyway, again, with the expectation that climate change is going to be affecting weather systems, NASA is hoping to try and work to utilize this new Cyclone Global Navigation Satellite System in an effort to track cyclones and, of course, you know, intense storms in the future. This goes well, hand-in-hand, in fact, with something we've discussed over the last few weeks here on the show, because many are saying with the new administration, not only are we asking questions about the future of our activities in space, we're also asking questions about how that will affect climate science and the study of it. So these are all important things that we have to ask right now. And, you know, again, this CYGNSS system, the probes will make use of global positioning systems to closely monitor the surface roughness of oceans around the world. Researchers are going to use those and the information that they collect to try and determine the strength and intensity of storms based on surface wind speeds. There are a lot of ways that they can study this kind of stuff. But it's going to be interesting to see, indeed, how well these predictions will be. And, of course, what we will learn about things such as what's going on inside a hurricane's inner core. Yeah, fascinating stuff. Moving over, maybe, to ancient mysteries, archaeology, paleontology, and biology. You know, there was a farmer and a construction worker, and this probably sounds like a joke, right? But no, in China, they apparently discovered, these fellas, discovered the remains of a new species of bird-like dinosaur. Matt, you sent this story to me earlier today, and I have to say it's quite interesting. This poor little guy got stuck in the mud. and never quite made it out. But the experts who have now discovered the evidence of this dinosaur, its fossil remains, they're saying that this adds weight. This one's quite significant, in fact, because of the fact that it seems to add weight to the idea that animals like this were thriving shortly before a mass extinction that occurred 66 million years ago, which, you know, we talked about a comet impact last week, this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. Well, again, paleontologists believe that the Chicxulub crater site, okay, is probably representative of a impact site that occurred, again, in that neighborhood of 66 million years ago, and that probably led to the mass extinction of the dinosaurs. Around the size of a sheep, but it had a beak and wings, okay, and a crest on it, said this creature, it was flightless, but it was nonetheless a very bird-like dinosaur, a species of oviraptor. Well, actually, it's actually an oviraptorosaur, I think, is the proper term. But these were bird-like, feathered and toothless, short-skulled, non-avian dinosaurs that were roaming the land. Experts are saying if you'd seen this little guy today, you wouldn't really be able to distinguish it from a bird. You would say it looked like a weird bird, but it nonetheless looked like a bird more than it looked like a dinosaur. And they said it looked like it got trapped in mud, and that's probably how it died. The neck is arched, the head is raised up. This, according to Stephen Brusati. He's a paleontologist with the University of Edinburgh. And he says it's got its head raised up like it's sticking its head above something, and both the arms are outstretched to the sides of the body, so it's like it's trying to free itself from the mud. A moment from the ancient past captured in time that we're able to observe today. Quite fascinating.
And I tell you, the name they gave it...
The Muddy Dragon?
Yes, the Muddy Dragon on the Road to Heaven. I think that is so awesome.
Yeah, it's quite neat. The little guy was found near a high school in Gangjin, near the Yangtze province in southern China. I'm sorry, Yangtze. Got it? Not Zhangji, but yeah, you got me. So the fossils were unearthed by construction workers, as aforementioned, who were using TNT to blast away the rocks, and sadly they think that utilizing the TNT probably led to the destruction of part of the fossil. But I mean, you know, this is a problem that we face when we have construction sites and things like this. A lot of things get destroyed, and when it comes to archaeology, you know, that more jobs in America held by archaeologists are in the field of cultural resource management. You know, let's say that they're out there and they're building a new series of condominiums, and they're down there and they're excavating. Well, they're not excavating, I'm sorry. They're you know, cutting into the earth and everything, and they're removing, and then they find something that seems to be an ancient human settlement. That's what happens. They have to call cultural resource management and get these people in there, and they have to go in and assess whether or not this site has to be protected. And so one of the fears, of course, naturally, that arises from this is that in some instances, people who are like, well, we don't want our building site to have to be commandeered by the state or something like that and become some important archaeological site, and therefore we don't get to build our condominiums here. One of the concerns that some people have is that there are instances where there may be precious locations of importance in terms of ancient human ancestry or maybe of paleontological significance like this, and things are sometimes destroyed, whether inadvertently or sometimes with full knowledge of what's being built over. You got me? In this instance, again, they were blasting with TNT, and it was reported that apparently, unexpectedly, this brought some of the remains to light, but it also appears to have blown away parts of the fossil, this precious fossil. But then again, I mean, weighing our extremes here, I mean, we either would never have known about it, or we've got a fossil fragment as a result of the blasting, which in this case I think actually was a positive thing. So thought to have lived between 72 million and 66 million years ago, this newly discovered dinosaur sheds light on the ecosystem just before that fateful asteroid strike. They say not only were there still a lot of dinosaurs, but they were actively diversifying, and there were still many new species that were coming about, and that, of course, we today are still finding. So this particular discovery of Oviraptorosaur adds weight to the argument that rather than being in decline before the mass extinction, it seems that dinosaurs might have been flourishing at around that time. And they say it doesn't win the argument one way or the other. This, according to Paul Upchurch, of the University of... he's with University College in London. He's a paleontologist as well. But he says it is another point in favor, perhaps, of suggesting that there were certainly some places in the world where, yeah, dinosaurs were, in fact, doing just fine prior to that great big old asteroid smacking into the Earth. We learn a lot of things as we look to the ancient past. And right now, looking to the future, again, this is quite interesting, Matt. We have a new study the BBC reported on. Did you see this about the implant
Yeah.
That was tested, yes, on a primate. Okay, rhesus monkeys that were paralyzed in one leg due to being or suffering a damaged spinal cord. It appears that a new variety of implant that beams instructions out of the brain has been used to restore movement in these paralyzed primates. And this is the first time that any kind of primate has apparently been able to do this. This has tremendous implications for restoring movement to those who are victims of paralysis. Now, apparently, experts said that this technology could be ready for human trials within a decade. BBC reports that spinal cord injuries block the flow of electrical signals from the brain to the rest of the body, resulting in paralysis. And it's a wound that rarely heals, but one potential solution is to use technology that bypasses that injury altogether, because what this really seems to have a lot to do with is when the injury occurs on the spinal cord, there is a breakdown in terms of the way that the electrical impulses being sent by the brain communicate with the rest of the body. So if we can utilize technology to overcome those kind of things, okay, and to renew that ability to communicate with parts of the body where there has previously been a hindrance, we may be able to restore movement in certain parts of the body when paralysis occurs. That is really exciting. In this study, there was a chip that was implanted into the part of the monkey's brain that controls movement. And naturally, its job was to read the spikes of electrical activity that are the instructions for moving the legs and send them to a nearby computer. It was deciphered that the messages and then instructions that were sent to this implant in the monkey's spine electrically were able to stimulate the appropriate nerves. And the process basically really takes place in real time. And the results, they said, this was published in the journal Nature, seem to show that the monkeys regained some control of their paralyzed leg within just 6 days and could walk in a straight line on a treadmill. Yeah. Dr. Gregory Cortin, one of the researchers, said this is the first time that a neurotechnology has restored locomotion in primates. So this is naturally, you know, so hopeful for people, I think, because we've seen things like the idea of exoskeleton suits and things like this that may be utilized and may be controlled externally, but in a way that may restore movement for people. Well, we now may also have internal processes that can do the same sort of a thing. But what we are seeing also, we aren't seeing the mechanization of humankind just yet, but we are certainly seeing a cyborg component. We are seeing the pairing of natural human biology, which sometimes is due to onset of illness or injuries. It may become biologically irreparable, but with the combination of mechanisms and technological innovations that can bypass the natural functions of the body or improve upon them, we are now seeing the quality of life being improved. People's quality of life indeed may be improving, but again, I guess we have to kind of look to the future and say, where eventually will this take us? I mean, at what point did the technologies become so great that we can not only improve quality of life and we can heal the wounded, we can literally grant sight to the blind and movement to the paralyzed? What happens when we don't need to improve upon ourselves, but we have the technologies to do so? Inevitably, I think, at some point, there will be humans that will do this for the sake of, well, mere folly, perhaps, improvement for the sake of whether it be cosmetic or you know, some sort of a physical, you know, strength enhancement, any number of things. Militarization of that technology is one thing that has to be considered also.
Oh, I think that's the first thing that's going to be considered, honestly, but unfortunately.
Well, you know, I mean, again, there's the medical benefit of these kinds of scientific advancements, but then there is the militarization of new technologies that, again, to me, will be inevitable. We look back to the Second World War, and something that Stalin had been really interested in trying to do was to try and hybridize humans and other kinds of ape species, okay, great apes, primates. He wanted to try and utilize genetic hybridization between things like chimpanzees or orangutans and humans for purposes of, can you guess? He wanted to create an army of super soldiers that were resistant to cold, that didn't complain a lot when they didn't have a whole lot of rations, and that were naturally more powerful, physically endued with strength than the average man. Fortunately, he never succeeded, as far as we know, with these kinds of experiments. But I was interviewed by, of all people, actually Michael Braverman and the folks with the conspiracy theory program that the governor, the former governor, Jesse Ventura, had been on. And they called me and interviewed me about this, wanting to know my personal opinion, actually over a course of a few phone calls. Do you think that there's any evidence this has been done? And I said, no, but I said, if there's a military application, I would find it hard to believe that the combinations of whether technologies or biological properties that can be taken and harnessed from various kinds of fauna, perhaps flora as well, and used in a way to enhance humans in a kind of a, almost in the creation of literal chimeras. Yeah, there's certainly that possibility, and I think that if it can be done and there's a military application for it, in likelihood it will be done. That's what I told him at the time. There isn't any evidence that it's occurring right now, and that there are literally people out there who have, you know, night vision because they've got cat's eyes, and they've got, you know, superhuman strength, and they've got monkey tails, and they can swing from branches and do kind of crazy things, and they've got cat's claws, you know, that they've got Spider-Man-like abilities to crawl up walls. I haven't seen evidence of that. I don't know if anybody really has, but again, I just say that it could be inevitable. If and when the technology exists, if there is a military application or a necessity for it, you know, I wonder sometimes if those kind of things, and this is what Mac Tony's before he died, but a lot of people in terms of artificial intelligence and futurism today, a lot of people refer to as an eventual post-human era in which the technologies at our disposal and the application of those technologies to humankind and to, in a way that I guess kind of takes us off the course of natural evolution and puts us into a position where we are evolving or changing ourselves, it's beyond evolution at that point. We've taken that ability into our own hands. We can speed it along as much as we like. We can utilize genetic sciences and any number of other things to improve not just the thinking capacity, but the physical attributes of humans. A post-human era, if we live that long, if no natural cataclysms prevent us from getting to that point. So the question is, should we live that long? Will that be an eventuality, an inevitable future for humans in which we aren't really humans anymore at all?
Well, I think it's a bit premature at this point to kind of theorize about being in a post-human society or anything like that. If you're familiar, Yiannis Varoufakis, who was the Greek prime minister, or Greek minister of finance, right after the debt crisis there was actually an interesting lecture he was doing at the New School up in New York, where he actually talks about the progression of technology. And we are at a very exciting juncture right now as far as technology goes, but we have to look what comes next. And what he postulates in this lecture, I think, is a very real crisis that we kind of will face with the technology issue prior to this kind of bio-integration of technology, the singularity-type idea. And that is that what happens when human beings reach the point of technological advancement, whereas you have the base levels of economics being, you know, land, labor, and capital, right? Mm-hmm. What happens when labor is taken out? What happens when the resources are taken out? Because the machines now do all the work. We could see...
We're already getting to that point. We're seeing some of that now.
So you're disenfranchising the entire workforce, and that could lead to a serious economic collapse on a world scale.
So maybe the economic implications of our movement toward post-humanity, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. I mean, again, obviously prior to what can verifiably be called post-human, there are going to have to be other things that come along the way, and perhaps part of that will be artificial intelligence apart from superhuman intelligence. I mean, so much to discuss. Corey Kowal, we had him on the show a while back talking about artificial intelligence, and he was just messaging me over the weekend. I know a lot of people in the listening audience have been thinking about this. In fact, maybe here in a moment we'll go to a few listener emails. I know that one sort of touches on this as well. More in a moment after this. It is the Graylian Report. Fresh out of hiding and into the light, I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. Matt Oakley still somehow makes his way down here on a weekly basis and joins me. He hasn't gone crazy, hasn't been driven mad as though following in the footsteps of the proverbial yellow king just yet. Hey, I'll tell you, by the way, part of the reason I'd been in hiding, after the election, I took a few days to collect myself in silence. Somber silence all by myself. But if you go to MicahHanks.com, you can go to that website URL /blog. I've got a bunch of articles about a variety of different subjects, and I did present my own summation, my thoughts about what's happening, most importantly right now in the nation, following the election. And so if you'd like to see some of my own thoughts, head over to my website and you can read about that there. I want to get to a few thoughts from you out there. Jeffrey writes, "More noon or eve to you, Micah. I was listening to the 11-7 episode of the Grayling Report, and you were discussing the simulated universe. Now, as part of the discussion, I believe you said something to the effect that it would seem counterproductive if humanity were to be destroyed by an asteroid. Now, that second, Matt, to the simulated universe itself has become the second most discussed item in recent weeks. Asteroid impact with Earth."
That was a great show, and I love that discussion, too.
There is another email that talks about that here in a moment, by the way.
Yeah.
So, Jeff writes that as long as we're going down that rabbit hole, I'd offer a slightly different view of this. You know, everyone seems to think that we are at the center of a simulated universe, because if there is a simulation, it would have to be all about us, because we are all special, special snowflakes. What if this is just a new version of the geocentric universe model? We might be part of the simulation, but who's to say we are the main component? If the simulation is of the universe, then we are just one small part and not central to all of it. See, Matt, that's funny because this email came in and I wasn't even thinking about that. What did I tell you to study before this show?
That is exactly what I was about to say. It's like, oh, sounds like some cosmicism going on here.
Yeah. The Lovecraftian philosophical attitude that really humans are largely insignificant in the grand scheme of the cosmos, which may or may not be the case. But, you know, there's some strange solace I take in that notion. That's why I want to talk about it. If we have time this week, we got a lot to get to in the next segment, but if we do have time to talk about cosmicism, I'd love to get to that. If not, it's going to be a special Grailian X episode that we'll do for the listeners, because it's something I really want to talk about. It's an area of philosophy which isn't recognized as an actual philosophical school. It really is just derived from the writings of H.P. Lovecraft, but it really has to do with what role do humans really play in all this? Do we just put ourselves at the top of the food chain because we're all we know? And we attribute so much self-importance to ourselves when, in fact, there may be an entire legion of cosmic entities out there. You know, elder gods, aliens, what do you, you know, if call them what you want, but they may not even have to exist for humans to play very little role in the grand scheme of things, as it were. And Lovecraft was all too well aware of that, despite having no proof or evidence and probably fundamentally not even believing in the existence of aliens himself. He probably thought that they were out there someplace. He certainly didn't seem to believe in a god as you or I might recognize it. But again, the philosophical attitude that he ascribed, it was sort of a cosmic nihilism, wasn't it? I think you even made sort of a reference to that, Matt. But so anyway, getting back to Jeff's email, he said, again, just to recap a bit, what if this is just a new version of the geocentric universe model? And then again, it could just be a game of some sort, maybe from some entity and their mom. And they just decided, hey, you know, let your little brother play too. We could be the product of a scenario managed by a six-year-old. It would help account for many things, wouldn't it? I won't take up any more of your time on this, so that's it for me. Love the show, and to the good Reverend, please thank him for being a part of it. Hey, Matt, thanks for being a part of what we do.
Hey, no problem.
Yeah. James writes, Micah, great show last week. I'm a geologist, and to me, it was one of the more interesting shows you've done in a while. Now, I wanted to make a couple of comments about the evidence of massive floods in the West at the end of the last major glaciation in North America. I've personally seen the features that the guest was talking about, and it's quite awe-inspiring. It's generally accepted that the cause of the massive floods was that as the continental ice sheets began to melt, it occurred in a non-uniform pattern, and that the meltwater would pond, forming massive lakes. The lakes would be impounded by massive ice dams in mountain valleys, and as the melt continued, the dams would inevitably fail, releasing unimaginable amounts of water. Yeah. Absolutely. And this is exactly what Randall Carlson was talking about when we were up there around Halloween. Jason Pintrill and I visited him and our friends Judy, and Judy Welder, of course, hosts the event, but there were a lot of people there. And yeah, this is exactly what they're talking about. The ice dams, the release of the incredible amounts of water, and yeah, the floodplains and the evidence that we still see throughout the American Midwest today. This happened, James writes, many times as the ice sheets melted. I've always felt that this may be the source of some of the global flood myths found in many cultures. And I agree, by the way. I certainly do agree. In fact, I think Randall Carlson kind of makes that point, but not having so much to do with what we attribute to, for instance, you know, in the Mediterranean and in parts of, well, the Middle East, and really where the origin point of modern biblical flood myths are, but actually more interestingly in parts of South America and the cultural traditions there that also pertain to the Day of the Dead, mention of this what's called a broom star, which is obviously a reference to a comet's appearance and the tail resembling the, you know, the broom sweeping the sky, and a lot of cultural traditions that literally show a broom star coming down and sweeping the earth clean. Randall posits that why this might have been perceived that way is because in ancient times people see a comet, they observe the broom star, it smacks into the ice shelf at the well, you know, probably around that 13,000 year mark, and there's this massive flood, and whoever was around when that happened, there may have been cultural traditions that could have been carried along over the years that substantiate this much older, probably than we realize, mythos that associates broom stars, you know, an ancient flood of massive, epic proportions, all these kind of things. There's an awful lot about the past that we obviously haven't quite figured out. But again, trying to understand the geology and a number of different areas of science as it relates to the mythologies of our ancient world and kind of putting together this unique kind of an interpretation, it's endlessly fascinating to me. So James continues. He says, my second comment is about the effects of the Younger Dryas impact event. The guest hypothesized that the impact hastened the end of the last glacial period, but he didn't really expound on the actual mechanisms through which this would occur. I'm certain that great heat would have been caused in the general vicinity of the impact, however. The generally accepted idea, though, is that the large planetary impacts would cause a global cooling effect through the addition of particulate to the atmosphere. This would serve to actually slow the end of the glaciation, or even temporarily reverse it. Of course, we haven't read... or rather, we haven't really had an opportunity to measure this first, or firsthand, thankfully. But I think the scientific reasoning is fairly sound, so now that I've said that, I really do want to know your guest's scientific reasoning. Geology is the artful science, and then there's always more to learn. And contrary to what you may hear from the climate groups and certain politicians, the science is never settled. He says, no one's really 100% sure what all of the drivers of the major climate cycles are, but the theory of Milankovitch cycles, which he says I won't elaborate on here, is probably a fine start. Which, that's where I got excited in this email where I saw that. And I'm going to respond to some of this here in a moment. But he says, therefore, it's unlikely that single events like planetary impacts that didn't change the Earth's orbit would change the overall trend of the climate because the drivers are associated more with the mechanics of the Earth-Sun relationship. So thanks for your time. I'm looking forward to the next show. James, I've got one more email I want to try and get to, but we're up on a break. So when we come back, I want to respond to what James is talking about because I certainly want to address what kind of an effect a comet impact would have. Would there be sudden heating? In likelihood, yeah. Would that be fairly localized? Maybe. Could that still have much wider reaching effects? I certainly think so. Would there have been a cooling trend that followed? I think there's evidence of that. And finally, what in the world is a Milankovitch cycle? One of my very favorite things. And hence we'll talk about that when we return here on the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, on the internet. It is the Graylian Report. I am Micah Hanks. And that name, by the way, makes me easy to find anywhere out there in the world. Wherever you may be, you can find me at Micah Hanks on Twitter. But right now, you want to head over to Instagram and find me, Micah_Hanks on Instagram. Just put up an image of something, Matt, that we don't show the world very often. A live shot of me behind the Hollow Earth microphone right here. It's big. It's very big. It's a massive microphone, isn't it?
It is. And I'm glad you cropped the image as well to keep all the confidential information out of the picture.
Controversial, yes, but no confidential. But if you head over to Instagram and follow me right there, Micah_Hanks, you can see that image live on the air, bringing it to you from down here in the bunker. Glad to do so, as we always do. Every week. And for those of you out there who want to make your own little sojourn down into the Hollow Earth, be a part of what we do. Join us in the tradition of the Evil Dead. That's right.
Join us.
Join us. Sign up for Graylian X. It's easy to do, fun, and inexpensive. $7 a month. Less than what you'll pay for fast food that you don't need to be eating anyway. So just head over to graylianreport.com/X. Sign up. Get additional weekly shows featuring the Graylian Gang and I, and also the monthly specials known as Graylian Enigmas. Got a lot of great feedback, of course, on the last episode. People have been tweeting about it, emailing about that. They always do. That's one of the more popular shows that we produce. So, Matt, in the last segment, we were, of course, talking about James's email. And I want to kind of get to a few things in this, although I'm not Jason Pentrell, the fellow who was on the show with us last week. But more than him being a guest, Jason is a research associate and certainly an honorary member of the Graylian Gang. And a couple of the points that we made were, is there scientific evidence that suggests that this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis seems to have shown the hastening of the end of the Ice Age? Well, actually, no. And what we know is that climate data, okay, now how do we have climate data dating back 13,000 years? This is what's known as proxy data. And we've utilized proxy climate data for a long time to be able to understand what was happening with climate trends in the ancient past. And there are actually a lot of ways that you can do this. You can extract this kind of data from drilling into ice cores or into coral reefs. You can collect it from sediment at the bottom of natural lake beds. Dendrochronological data, i.e. what's, of course, known in layman's terms as tree ring data. We can look back and we can see that the distance between the rings in the growth of trees on an annual rate is sometimes greater or is sometimes less, and that is indicative of temperature trends also. So we can learn an awful lot about trends that occurred in climate here on Earth long ago from this kind of data. And interestingly, that data, if memory serves, not only seems to indicate that there was an anomalous warming trend toward the end of the last ice age, but yes, the warming trend occurred, and then, of course, temperatures resumed there for a while, and it got cooler, and then the ice age naturally ended, and we came out of that glacial period. So actually, the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis does not in any way attempt to make a case that the end of the last ice age was hastened, only that there was an anomalous warming period toward the end of that that ice age. And so what modern scientists have tried to understand is what caused the warming trend, and the impact hypothesis is one of a number of competing theories. And that's what Jason and I were talking about, and what we went to Dr. Albert Goodyear at the University of South Carolina to discuss. Well, that and also that Topper site, which we spent a good bit of time talking about. And so anyone at home, if you haven't heard that show yet, definitely go back and listen to the episode in question, which would have been November 7th, 2016 was the date of the release. And again, I think that there is more and more evidence that does suggest that there is in likelihood, probably plenty of data that supports some kind of an impact that occurred around that time, and that indeed may have been at least in part what was contributing to that warming period that we see. What's really interesting, though, is I first heard about, well, I've heard about it for years, but that Younger Dryas warming that we're discussing here, it was something that was referenced by Randall Carlson. And the first time that I attended one of his lengthy private seminars, I remember seeing this unusual, what's described as a sawtooth kind of a pattern. And I was digging into, there was a New York Times article earlier this year that was talking about the way that megafauna die-offs in Patagonia in likelihood had to do with pressures that were brought about by their interactions with ancient humans. And when I was going to the abstract on the article that was linked in the New York Times article, one of the things that they talked about, of course, was something that I'd never heard of at that point called Milankovitch cycles. And they referred to it as being the familiar sawtooth pattern. And I remember thinking, whoa, I know what they're talking about. I'd remembered seeing this in various geological and climatological data. And studying up on Milutin Milankovitch, interestingly, he was, first of all, not really a climate scientist. Milankovitch, I wrote an article about him at Mysterious Universe, and if you go online, you can Google this. It's titled, the article, that is, The Mystery Ice Age, How a Mathematician Unraveled Ancient Climate Change. And I cite the New York Times article in question. And in that article earlier this year, I wrote, the study appearing in Science Advances is one of the many papers that suggest an increasingly popular trend, the role that humans have played in relation to environmental change since ancient times, as well as the periodicity of climate change throughout history. And in this instance, the human influence has been additional pressure placed against megafauna species. Well, the idea of periodic climate change throughout ancient history, despite its increasing appearance in current news, is hardly new as far as ideas go. Information gleaned from the study of ice cores, well, we've talked about a little of that anyway. The article really kind of goes over a lot of the things I've already talked about. But Vincent Morgan is the one who wrote the paper that was titled The Antarctic Cold Reversal, that I found online, which described this period in great detail, and it noted the continuing periodicity of climate changes throughout history, based on the work of Milutin Milankovitch. He was a Serbian scientist, mathematician, really. And the abstract in part reads, the transition between the last glacial period and the Holocene is the most recent of a series of major changes in climate that have occurred throughout the Quaternary as the Earth cycled between glacial and interglacial conditions. These cycles, often referred to as Milankovitch cycles after Milutin Milankovitch, the Serbian mathematician who first showed that climate cycles are synchronized with cycles in the Earth's orbit, are characterized by a sawtooth pattern in which temperature decreases to a minimum over a period of about 90,000 years and then rises to a warm or interglacial values within about 10,000 years. Long story short, there are three things that, according to Milankovitch, account for this, and they are the eccentricity, the axial tilt, and then, oh gosh, what's the third one? I'm trying to recall all this from memory here, so forgive me. But precession, I'm sorry. I always forget. Precession, the third, yeah. So, yeah. Precession, axial tilt, and eccentricity. And essentially, these features of Earth's orbit, okay, actually contribute to that 90,000-year cooling and heating and cooling and heating, or, well, really not a heating so much as a cooling and a thawing cycle that occurs. So climate change in that context is inevitable. I'm not trying to say that current anthropogenic global warming is bunk and that climate science is nil. I'm not saying that at all. A lot of people get offended when I talk about this long-standing knowledge that certainly relates to climate science, especially over much broader periods of geological history. What's interesting to me is that, of course, can be recognized as well as modern climate science. But I don't hear many modern climate scientists talk about the Milankovitch cycles. And that's why I would like to be able to have further dialogue with more people in the scientific community who are climate science experts, because I would like to, you know, get their opinion about, the Milankovitch cycles and how this actually affects, again, throughout geological history, much broader climate trends that do have to do with, well, things that don't involve humans. So again, I think that to say that one exists doesn't necessarily have to say that the other doesn't exist. And when I try and bring this up, people are like, see, you've debunked what we already knew was a hoax, climate change. I'm like, no. I'm not saying climate change is not real. In fact, this only furthers, I think, the sentiment that climate change is very real, but there are indeed a variety of factors that contribute to it. And today, I think it's very difficult to say that humans don't play, at least a significant role in that. That's what we call anthropogenic climate change. But there's a difference. So I thought it was really interesting that James would bring that up in his email, because not only is that something that I am very interested in, but also Milankovitch apparently began studying these cycles based on this anomalous warming trend, which today, of course, some theorists attempt to account for with what is known as the Younger-Dryas impact hypothesis. So it brings us full circle. And James, I really appreciate you get email of the week for that one, because, again, it is important. As Dr. Andy White told us when we were down there at the University of South Carolina, we have to try and have spirited and consistent and frequent dialogue if we're going to try and understand these things. There are some people in the skeptical community who like to just, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're stupid, and you're wrong. There is no such thing as dialogue for those people. And frankly, that's why I don't have dialogue with individuals like that. But I invite dialogue from interested, learned, and patient people who are willing to express their ideas and perhaps to accept new ideas into their own sphere of knowledge. That's what is important about this show and why we do it. It is the Graylian Report. And so thank you, guys. info@graylianreport.com, info@micahhanks.com. I think that's about all the time really we have for emails this week, but I've got a few I'd like to get to. We'll have to save for another time. More important things, though, that we want to discuss leading up to the heart of the hour, because there's something, a really interesting phenomena that I've wanted to kind of weigh in on for a while now. But kind of as a preface to that, Matt, is this story that we have from Futurism.com. And the headline reads, Harvard may have pinpointed the source of human consciousness. Now, I think that just like we've got the time of the physicist and the time of the philosopher, or perhaps the time of the doctor, you know, we also, I think, have the consciousness of the neuroscientist, which is something that they think can be physically pinpointed. And then I think there is the consciousness of, well, we might say the philosopher. Again, is consciousness something that is just a byproduct of you know, being awake and aware and having a brain? I think that there are differing interpretations of what the definition of consciousness actually is.
I have to bring up a point. You know, I come more from a philosophical school of thought. My point of contention on anything other than having a philosophical approach to consciousness would be, what would be the evolutionary benefit of many of the questions that we ask ourselves or have searched for the answers to throughout society? What's the evolutionary benefit of constantly searching for some sort of a higher power as a you know, race or species? There's no evolutionary benefit to that I can see. Of course, many I think would introduce the point of view that, well, oh, it's created by the people in power to keep the masses in you know, servitude, so to speak.
Well,
I guess.
Matt, and actually, well, in likelihood, consciousness is a illusion created by the secret societies too to keep the sheeple in line. Consciousness is just an illusion.
Okay, I'll shut up from here then.
Well, that answers your question, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I see what you're saying, though. Actually, what evolutionary benefit do we glean from the furtherance of? Well, the furtherance of knowledge is one thing, but I think you're kind of talking more about the introspective question of who are we and what are we.
That question of spirituality that we discuss, not in a religious sense, but in a you know, self-serving sense, I guess.
Maybe rather than self-serving, I would say self-reflecting.
Well, yeah.
But you know, what's funny is I think that the modern physicist owes much to not asking that question and trying to, you know, literally expel that from the mind. If I ask too much about what's going on inside, it will lessen my ability to objectively observe those things external to me, which are really the important things. Hence, really, that being, I think, why I think so many modern physicists are so down on philosophy. Well, we can get so hung up on those questions about what if and who are and why, you know, and I think, therefore, I am, that we aren't really thinking about what's going on in the universe. Hence, they say philosophy hasn't kept up. I vehemently disagree. I mean, I maintain that we have to ask, well, why are we asking these questions in the first place? Why are we able to think? Are we really the only really critically thinking species on this earth, let alone possibly in the universe? Which really, again, man, it's funny because without actually getting into a discussion about cosmicism, we're already kind of getting into the discussion of cosmicism.
And you think about, are we the only species? There are species even here on this planet, such as whales, that build emotional bonds to situations, people, places. You know, that's proven scientifically. But there's no species that researches, for lack of a better term, I guess, their humanity like humans do.
In addition to study, well, again, many would argue that, again, humans are the only ones who study, period. Mm. And rather than, you know, again, the active participation in understanding the world around us merely than just existing within it. But, you know, again, that even to an extent, and this is very philosophical, and this is where we do run the risk of getting so far down the rabbit hole that we've kind of lost our path. again, you know, that idea alone could be anthropomorphized as well, or anthropomorphized, I guess, might be the term, but I digress, as I tend to do. So this Harvard article, quite interesting. Yeah, these are the big questions, though. I mean,
I love these conversations.
I do, too. I do, too, and I know that the listeners do also, because over time, as you can kind of tell, the Gray Alien Report has had less to do with the gray alien and more to do with the grail itself, that holy grail, whatever that may represent for anybody. And that mythic imagery, again, I think throughout all cultures represents, well, what is that ultimate truth we're all trying to find? Hence why people refer to the holy grail of blank, you know, this or that. I mean, we're kind of on that quest. We're trying to find the right question to ask, much like Percival, you know, in the Hall of the Fisher King in those earliest Graylian legends. And it's so funny how it's come to fruition for me that where we began with this podcast and our own personal interests and lines of inquiry have led to, into much deeper areas of thought. And we are so blessed as to be able to share that interaction and that dialogue with you guys out there on a weekly basis. So human consciousness is really at the heart of all of this. So I'm glad that we kind of started with that discussion of, well, okay, how do we define consciousness? What is it? And here's what Harvard has to say about it most recently. Human consciousness, of course, according to neuroscience, is defined as awareness, sentience, and a person's ability to experience and feel. But despite the important role that it plays in our lives and making us who we are, we actually know very little about how consciousness works. Again, all debate over that definition aside. Now, scientists currently believe that consciousness is composed of these two components primarily, okay, arousal and awareness. The first is regulated by the brainstem, but the physical origins of the latter were always a mystery, and now a team of researchers at Harvard think that they may have discovered the regions of the brain that work with the brainstem to maintain consciousness itself. For the first time, we have found a connection between the brainstem region involved in arousal and regions involved in awareness, two prerequisites for consciousness. This according to Michael D. Fox. Michael Fox, not Michael J., but Michael D., his crazy twin brother. He also happens to be a professor and director at the Laboratory for Brain Network Imaging and Modulation and the associate director of the Berenson Allen Center for Non-Invasive Brain Simulation at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Now, a lot of pieces of evidence all came together to point to this network playing a role in human consciousness. To better understand why some patients were able to maintain consciousness despite injuries while others went into comas, the researchers analyzed 36 patients with brainstem lesions. 12 of those patients were in a coma and were unconscious, and 24 were defined as conscious. They discovered that 10 of the 12 unconscious subjects had damage in the rostral dorsolateral pontine tegmentum, a small area of the brainstem with a very large name. Now, only one out of the 24 conscious subjects had damage in that same area. Evidently, this tiny part of the brainstem had a lot to do with maintaining consciousness. Looking into this a little further, they studied a brain map of a healthy brain where they were able to pinpoint two areas that were linked to the rostral, well, DPT region. This led them to conclude that the connections between those areas and the identified region of the brainstem likely play a role in the regulation of consciousness itself. And from knowing virtually nothing except the possibility that it could be located in the cortex, scientists have now identified two specific cortex regions that they believe could be essential to human consciousness. And so exciting as this discovery may be, Futurism.com reported this. They say, as exciting as this discovery may be, it is only the first step. From here, the researchers' findings must be confirmed, of course, by independent groups, and further studies must be conducted using larger groups of subjects. But if those researchers are right, and if they've identified areas in the human brain that are responsible for consciousness as we define it, the knowledge would prove invaluable to patients in comas and vegetative states and their families, as it could lead to new kinds of treatments. One of those many examples of how technology is indeed allowing us to learn more about our complex biology. But Matt, this got me thinking about something that we were discussing with Jason down there when we were doing Research Week 2016 in Charleston. Now, you remember we had the Ouija discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember we had the discussion about the mammoth's tooth and all the paleontological stuff over there on the coffee table, right?
Yeah.
But do you remember the other thing that we discussed? There was a weird news story that we were talking about.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And it has to do with a very unusual medical disorder that has really got me thinking about the functions of the brain And much like this study, it involves people who enter comas, but when they come back out of this coma, they're a little different. Imagine you wake up into a hospital room, and the nurse comes over and asks you how you're feeling, and you answer, but you don't recognize your own voice. More importantly, maybe it is your accent, or perhaps even the language you speak that you don't recognize. Now, this is where things get really weird. More in a moment when we come back here on the Gray Lane Report. Welcome back. It is the Gray Lane Report. Glad to be here with you. So we've been talking about the mysteries of consciousness. Thanks to the Go Devils, by the way, there.
Love that band.
Little bit of the Lover's Blood. You know, before we continue any further here, Matt, I think maybe there's one really important thing that we should probably get right now. You know what that is, right?
I can only guess, but yeah. I'm gonna wait for you to tell me.
Yeah, that is...
News from the front!
Hey, Hobo, you there?
Yes, sir.
What's happening over there in Arkansas? I just wanted to check in on you because, you know, people say they love you so much and they haven't heard enough from you because I've been rambling. I've been the rambling man tonight, so.
Well, you've been rolling and doing a great job of it, as you always do with Matt, throwing logs on the fire.
Yes, yes, yes. Not Yule logs quite yet, but the holidays are almost upon us. And it's going to be Christmas time here at KGRA because I guess it's not too early to say that there are going to be some really great things coming here in the next few months, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're going to notice a lot of really cool stuff coming to the KGRA. When I say really cool stuff, it's stuff that we probably should have had a long time ago and did have some a while ago, but now it's about to be a whole different ball game for all of you, and all of the listeners are going to be the ones who reap all the benefits from the from these upgrades that we're about to make for 2017. It's going to be a fun time to be hanging out with KGRA in 2017.
Well, we do try to bring a lot of professionalism to broadcasts that we bring to you. As good quality as anything that you would hear on any mainstream major news radio network. And I've actually had people write to me and they're like, you know, it's so funny because you can do a live show, you guys, and you make it sound like it was a podcast that was well edited and put together with all the pieces all thrown in there, and it's polished as it goes to air. And yes, we are actually live, by the way, Matt. Instagram is going nuts after we put that image up there. So, yeah, that's why it sounds good. If you think that we do a good job, folks, we're just having fun. We're a lot of dedicated professionals who have a lot of fun doing what we do, and we like to bring you guys along for the ride. So, always good to have Hobo there because, well, you know, every week Hobo brings us something really important.
News from the front.
I'll tell you though, Micah, I'm really looking forward to the most, and that's going to be the ability to call into the programs as well as the new mobile apps that are coming out. They're going to be state-of-the-art mobile apps for radio. You're going to love them. They're going to have all the bells and whistles, and that's one of my favorite things that we're going to be able to bring to the listeners in 2017. We'll be with you. Fully integrated to the KGRA website anywhere you go.
That's going to be really, really good. Phones are changing the way of the future. You don't just pick them up and say hi to people any longer.
Hello, hello. Rubbish robots from the dawn of time.
That's what I'm going to be saying, though, every time I pick up my phone. That should just be my voicemail.
I tell you, you say way of the future, and any time anybody ever says that phrase, all I can think about is DiCaprio in The Aviator,
mm-hmm.
you know, playing Howard Hughes, and I just immediately want to jump in and just keep saying it out, way of the future, way of the future, way of the future.
It's going to be the way of the future. Well, you know, again... waking up and saying hello, you don't have to necessarily wake up and say hello. That could be kind of intimate, I guess, you know. But let's say you call somebody on the phone and say hello. You know what I'm saying. Again, it's kind of interesting. And getting back to what we were... What are you laughing at?
I just wanted to say real quick...
Yeah?
I just wanted to say real quick, Father Ashcraft, thank you so much. He posts in the Graylian Interactive chat room. A live and interactive chat room. The KJRE's quality is leaps and bounds ahead of other stations of similar content. And, you know, everybody's in there agreeing and high-fiving and all. We love you guys in the chat. We appreciate you guys hanging with us. And you know, KJRE Radio.com/chat room to all of you who want to participate in Micah Hanks's chat room. Be more than welcome to see you guys come in there. It's a lot of fun, good folks.
Sounds like it's functional.
Father Ashcraft.
Yes. And by the way, since I'm not in the chat room right now, I didn't know that Jack was in there, but pox to you, Father, and my good friend Jack Ashcraft right there. So blessings be upon you, my brother. Glad to hear that you're out there representing the clergy here on this podcast. We got a lot of friends, by the way, in the clergy who listen to this show, in addition to the science and the arts. You know, quite a diverse bunch we have. So I wanted to get to this story here. Imagine that you wake up. You've been asleep for you don't know how long. You start to speak. You sound different. You may not even be speaking a language that you recognize. Time Magazine reported on a story that Matt and I were following while we were in Charleston. It's taken us this long to get back around to this, but I wanted to do an entire segment talking about this unusual phenomenon. The most recent instance where this apparently happened involved a young man who was injured during a soccer game and wakes up and things are quite different when he does.
A Georgia teenager says he was able to speak solely in Spanish after coming out of a coma despite not knowing the language before. In a recent interview with WSB-TV, Ruben Nesemo's parents said he was speaking fluently in Spanish and not English when he woke up at an Atlanta hospital. Someone allegedly kicked the 16-year-old soccer player in the head during a game, causing him to suffer a concussion. So how did Nesemo suddenly pick up a new language? He told WSB Radio it could be because his brother and his friends are all fluent. Eventually, Nesemo's parents said his English came back while his Spanish-speaking skills disappeared. He wants to get back to playing goalie on the field. So does his coach, who says he must wear a helmet.
You know, this, again, is not something that is unrecognized by science. I mean, there is indeed a phenomena, a condition, in fact, recognized as foreign accent syndrome. It has its own Wikipedia page, and there are a lot of people who have described over the years waking up from comas and speaking in what appears to be a different accent. They usually speak the same language, but they speak it in a different different dialect or accent. Now, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page right now just because, for a quick reference, there's a salient point to be made here. The second paragraph there on the article reads, "Its symptoms result from distorted articulatory planning and coordination processes, and although popular news articles commonly attempt to identify the closest regional accent, speakers suffering from foreign accent syndrome acquire neither a specific foreign accent nor any additional fluency in a foreign language," they say. They acquire neither a specific foreign accent nor any additional fluency in a foreign language. Now, it says, despite an unconfirmed news report in 2010 that a Croatian speaker had gained the ability to speak fluent German after emergence from a coma, there has been no verified case where a patient's foreign language skills have improved after a brain injury. There have been a few reported cases of children and siblings picking up the new accent from someone with foreign accent syndrome. Now, that said... I would argue that while, again, they say scientifically there's no such evidence, there have been some unusual cases that maybe do suggest that if not improvement of a foreign language that they didn't speak before, there may be evidence that there are certain facilities of the mind in which a person may actually be able to recollect, maybe not consciously, but even whether or not they can consciously engage in in their memory of a language or exposure to it. After these kind of brain injuries, people do seem to have a marked increase in ability to speak in that dialect or that even different language. Such was the case with this particular gentleman we're about to hear from here, an Englishman who awoke unable to speak English any longer but could speak the Welsh language. He had only been exposed to people who spoke Welsh when he had had to evacuate during the Second World War and was sent to Wales, never learned the language, he said, lived alongside the Welsh people, wakes up from a coma decades later, only capable of speaking Welsh.
Wedi bod yn byw mwy o'r bran fwyaf yn Llundain, ond amser y rhyfel, es i lawr i dorjo'r bombs a pethau i Llwyncelyn.
And then what does that mean in English?
I was born in 1931, and when the war came, I was sent down as evacuee to Blancringo in Llwyncelyn. I was sitting in the chair watching television, and my wife noticed I wasn't really watching it at all. I seemed to have gone into a daze. So she rang on the phone and called an ambulance, which took me off to the hospital, and they lumbered me into bed after sorting me out. It was an amazing experience because I discovered after two or three days, when I was becoming a bit of compos mentis, that I was speaking totally Welsh, and only my wife could understand me. Having spent 3 weeks in hospital, I came out, and for quite a while, it was quite difficult to get myself understood, to get things done, because you were a bit weak on your legs. But gradually, my English came back, which was a major asset. Having learnt that I was only speaking Welsh, I had to find a way of learning English. So very early on, I got myself a good Welsh dictionary, which I kept looking at every now and again to make sure that the words I were using were correct. But gradually it all came back, but it didn't happen overnight.
Now that's a really interesting story to me because it's one of actually several similar instances where people have claimed that they have awoken from a coma, and although they initially may not be able to speak their native language, that usually does come back. But what they seem to be able to do is they seem to have an increased ability or fluency, contrary to what the Wikipedia article says. They appear to have an increased fluency in a language not that they have never spoken, but that they have had limited exposure to. Now, the Telegraph in the UK reported on this. This was reported, I think, in 2012. Alan Morgan was the man that you just heard from. He was 81 years old, evacuated to Wales during the Second World War, and left 70 years ago. And during that time where he was surrounded by Welsh speakers, he said he never learned that language for himself. He left the country at age 10 and lived his life in England and recently suffered a severe stroke. When Mr. Morgan regained consciousness 3 weeks later, doctors discovered he was speaking Welsh and could not remember any English. It is thought that the Welsh Mr. Morgan had heard as a boy had sunk in without him knowing and was unlocked only after he'd had the stroke. Now see, what I see, and we're going to look at some other cases that suggest that this is what is happening, that somehow the mind does absorb and does actually retain knowledge of experiences that are almost subliminal, and that later following a brain injury, despite his inability to speak his native tongue, the remembrance that he didn't seem to think that he actually had learned any Welsh nonetheless allows him to speak the language with an unprecedented fluency. There is what is referred to from time to time as the guerrilla skeptic presence on Wikipedia. And I think that people are naturally averse to the notion of, oh, wow, someone suffers brain damage and suddenly they wake up speaking a language that they didn't know before. That's obviously bunk. No evidence whatsoever. Well, again, it may not be that they'd never heard this and never knew this language before. Again, with Mr. Morgan here, following his stroke, he had had exposure to Welsh language, but he didn't think that he knew that language, had never spoken that language, never learned that language, and awakens from a stroke with the ability to speak said language. He said, I'd not lived in Wales since I was evacuated there during the war, and gradually the English words did come back, but it wasn't easy. He'd been watching the lunchtime news, he said, when his wife noticed that he was not responsive. She called for an ambulance. He was rushed into the hospital, where he spent 3 weeks being stabilized and assessed, the Telegraph reports. Doctors diagnosed Mr. Morgan with aphasia, a form of brain damage which causes a shift in the brain's language center. He was helped by the communication support service run by the Stroke Association in Bath. and of course eventually regained his ability to speak English, but he said there would be times where he would have a certain word in Welsh come to mind, so he got a Welsh dictionary so that he could reference and make sure he was saying the right words. And he said, indeed, the words that I didn't recognize but that came to mind when I was trying to say and articulate a certain thing were the correct Welsh terms in the dictionary. Didn't think he knew the language, he was able to speak it. Also in 2012, grandmother Kay Russell, age 49, of Bishop Cleeve in Gloucestershire, had suffered a migraine and began speaking in what she said sounded like a French accent. Sarah Caldwell, 35, in the Plymouth area of Devon, also suffered a migraine and began speaking in a Chinese accent. Which is funny because every time I have a migraine, the only accent I adopt is that of a sailor. I begin speaking in four-letter words.
Yeah.
Doctors say that they suffered what is known as foreign accent syndrome, a condition which damages the part of the brain that controls speech and word formation. More than 150,000 people have a stroke every year, and that's just in the UK, by the way. And a third end up with aphasia as a result. Now, there have been other instances I mentioned that I wanted to touch on here. We have a man who woke up in a hotel room in Palm Springs, California, had no idea who he was, suddenly was only speaking Swedish. This dated back to 2013. The story, you know, some of these I do think are a bit questionable, and we have to be very careful with them. But the story of this fella, Michael Boatwright. Boatwright showed up in a Motel 6 with 5 tennis rackets, a duffel bag, 2 cell phones, some old photos, identification, and a bit of cash. He had no idea who he was. He could only speak Swedish. A social worker assigned to help figure out who he was managed to piece together that he used to live in Japan and in China, but there was no evidence that he lived in Sweden, though he may have had sisters who lived there. So again, in this instance, it seems that he had probably had some limited exposure to that language. His American nationality didn't stop him from calling himself Johan Ek, despite Michael Boatwright being on his social security card, license, passport, and veteran's medical card, from which he apparently showed that he'd been in the Navy. And he isn't the only person to wake up from a coma or trauma speaking a different language. Jomir Masovic, she had fallen into a 24-hour coma in her native Croatia. Now, what happened apparently is she awoke from the coma speaking fluent German, a language that she had only just begun studying in school. Once again, she had some limited exposure to the language that she came out speaking. It was not her native language. We have a lot of these kind of cases. So the question, I think, is when someone has limited exposure and they aren't necessarily fluent in language, are there processes of the mind, functions of the brain that allow a deeper knowledge and a deeper ability, you know, a retention of that knowledge than is overtly apparent? Is there a subconscious aspect of the mind, in other words, the brain that is able to process and learn and retain knowledge that in the event of brain damage, when the, you know, the primary function of language in the brain is compromised, the brain resorts to some sort of a subliminal layer of information that is nonetheless stored within the brain and capable of being recalled in a way that allows a fluency in a language that, no, they had not never heard or never spoken, but they had had at least limited exposure to.
And that's one way to look at it. I believe when we were down in Charleston with Jason, we started talking about one of the other theories where I kind of threw out that this may be some sort of biological key to the Tower of Babel, so to speak, where we actually contain this shared knowledge, this collective knowledge in our subconscious between all humans. A certain level of brain damage maybe unlocks the potential.
To the collective unconscious.
Exactly, yeah. That's outlandish, of course.
But it is. I mean, well, but, you know, I mean, again, Jung and many others have made that observation over the years, that there are instances where it seems that people are able to tap into something that's a deeper kind of a collective that seems to unite all humans. And if people were able to come out of a coma speaking a language they had never spoken or had any, you know, exposure to, you know, I wake up from a coma and suddenly I'm able to, you know, speak fluent Mandarin, or I'm able to speak, you know, fluent Czechoslovakian or whatever, you know, that would be interesting. But in almost every case, it seems that people have had limited exposure. Now, what's interesting, again, is if we go back to that Wikipedia article, though, where we seem to have instances where people can actually, even though they've had some exposure to these languages, they certainly do appear to have a increased fluency in a foreign language when they emerge from the coma and a temporary inability to articulate in their native tongue. Listen again to the terminology in the description given with the Wikipedia article. Its symptoms, foreign accent syndrome, result from distorted articulatory planning and coordination processes, and although popular news articles commonly attempt to identify the closest regional accent, speakers suffering from foreign accent syndrome acquire neither a specific foreign accent nor any additional fluency in a foreign language. Is that really a true statement?
That's supernatural is what it is, if you ask me.
Well, or what it is to me, Race, is that, again, in the Wikipedia article, they are so afraid that there is something supernatural being implied, which I don't think it really is. I don't really see it as being supernatural, but they're so
afraid. I think, Micah, I just want to say that I think that the, you know, the verbiage, the meaning of supernatural is just, you know, what it is. It's a description of something that the brain can do that we don't understand in the normal nominal sense.
Okay.
You know, just saw an article today about the CIA document that confirms the reality of humans with special abilities are able to do impossible things. Whether you go into a coma or you fall off a bike and hit your head or you kiss a girl or whatever it is that causes these things to happen are certainly understood more today. I mean, we've been looking into this stuff for more than a century, and modern day evidence suggests that there are abilities that are much more than folklore when you talk about mind matter relationships, in that sense. We've established that consciousness or factors associated with consciousness actually, you know, do in fact have observable effects, in the physical material world. Albeit, you know, there's a vast array of those effects. They're certainly, you know, have been proven to be true now, and scientifically so. And I want to say at the quantum level, the conversation and evidence is really, really getting more and more compelling. But, you know, when you talk about someone who has never spoken this language before, hanging around, been around, exposed to, it is in line with those stories we hear, Micah, about children who have an entire knowledge of someone who has been dead and gone for 50 years in detail, where they lived, the plane that they flew, where that plane crashed, and where they died. And these facts have been found to be true, and with no way, scientifically or otherwise, can it be proven that a hoax. And it's just, it's amazing to me that the human brain is so far more vast with its potential than we have any idea. That's where I go with supernatural.
Well, yeah, that's actually
long, and that long sort of narrative.
No, and that's actually a good definition, Race. You know, because again, coming back to what Matt was discussing, which actually Jared Drake sent along, the observation of earthquake lots prior to a earthquake, which thus leads to a tsunami risk, and there was an actual tsunami that struck New Zealand. You know, in ancient times, people made this association. They see something that they again perceived as supernatural merely because it wasn't understood at that time. Today, we don't have the full picture on earthquake lines, but we have a much clearer picture of what kinds of tectonic and seismic phenomena can lead to that, and we now understand, well, the light appears prior to an earthquake. When the earthquake occurs, naturally, there could be property damage. There may be even worse things in the case of a tsunami. And so naturally, in ancient times, it doesn't seem strange, really, if we think about it, that people would see these lights and say, we associate the appearance of a mysterious light with, you know, something bad that's going to happen. There's going to be ill fortune coming our way. Something wicked this way comes. And when we think about the supernatural within that kind of designation, yeah, things that we don't understand through modern science nonetheless may hint at verifiable features of nature that if we are open-minded enough to, rather than saying it doesn't exist and it cannot exist, i.e. no evidence according to what even, you know, these news articles write, again, maybe there isn't anything to foreign language syndrome. Maybe there isn't anything to kids who seem to have remembrances from past lives. Maybe there's nothing to any of this stuff. Maybe it is all bunk. But again, to me, what I see is that, unfortunately, I think there is such a rampant pathological skepticism at times. No, it isn't. No, it can't. No, it won't. No, it doesn't. That we aren't open-minded enough to see things that may not be supernatural forever. They may have been that at one time, but they may not have to remain that. They may be actual facets of the physical universe from which, if we studied them, we might learn. We'll wrap things up here in a moment after this. It is the Graylian Report. From the dark heart of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. I am Micah Hanks. In the final moments of this week's broadcast, I do just want to pay tribute to and sincere thanks to Mr. Matt Oakley and, of course, to Race Hobbs for being a part of the Graylian gang on a weekly basis. You guys are wonderful, and without the two of you and many of you out there, this show wouldn't be what it is on a weekly basis. Final thoughts here in this last very short segment of the Graylian Report. I just want to say that, again, we're not trying to just pander woo-woo when we study things like foreign accent syndrome and some instances where people maybe do awake from such circumstances capable of possessing a fluency in a language that they had had limited exposure to, maybe even early in life. I don't think that it's crazy to suppose that there are some strange phenomena in nature that we can learn from if we examine not only the folkloric and the mythological observations of these kind of things and interpretations by ancient cultures, but also the modern phenomena and the scientific interpretation of these kind of things. There is a narrative that begins to emerge when we do, and when we become so skeptical that we will disallow a possibility even in the face of observable data, anecdotal though that evidence may be, we do know better if we rule out what we don't understand without seeking to say first, is there something worthy of study? Is there a phenomena? We can sweep it under the rug as much and as often as we like, but that doesn't make it go away. And if there's something worth studying, we should afford it that chance through science and through intelligent inquiry. That's the final word this week on the Graylian Report. Thank you, Matthew, for always participating in what we do.
Oh, thank you for having me, as always.
Indeed, and on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, Race and Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, I remain your doctor here in the dark heart of the Hollow Earth. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. You guys stay strange out there. Until next time.
You've been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.